Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Bobbi Jean Schweitzer, professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University and an associate editor for Anesthesiology. And you are listening to an anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. Today, we are speaking with two authors of publications that appear in the May 2021 issue of the journal. With us is Dr. Glenn S. Murphy. Dr. Murphy is the first author of an article titled Perioperative Methadone and Ketamine for Postoperative Pain Control in Spinal Surgical Patients, a Randomized Double-Blind Placebo-Controlled Trial. Dr. Murphy is an anesthesiologist at Illinois Masonic Hospital here in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome, Dr. Murphy.
Thank you. It's great to be here today.
And joining Dr. Murphy is Dr. J. David Clark. Dr. Clark wrote an accompanying editorial, Methadone and Ketamine, Boosting Benefits and Still More to Learn. Dr. Clark is a professor of anesthesiology at the Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System in Palo Alto, California, in the Department of Anesthesiology at Stanford University School of Medicine in Stanford, California. Welcome, Dr. Clark.
Hello. I'm happy to join you today.
So let's start with you, Dr. Murphy. You have published before on the use of methadone in patients having spine surgery. I believe, in fact, in this journal, Anesthesiology. What specific question did you aim to address with your latest study?
Well, actually, this latest study was inspired by our previous study. In that previous study, we had randomized patients who are undergoing spinal surgery to receive a dose of methadone or standard intraoperative opioids. And what we found was the group that got the methadone did a lot better postoperatively. We found that analgesic requirements were reduced by about 50%, and pain scores were significantly reduced also. But the problem was when we actually looked at these patients, the patients in the methadone group still had quite a bit of pain. Pain scores tended to be moderate in the 4 to 6 range, and analgesic requirements were also in a relatively high range, about 5 milligrams of hydromorphone in the first 24 hours. So with this new study, what we were looking at is, could we further enhance analgesia by adding ketamine to methadone, two agents that act on the NMDA receptor?
So what were the specific primary and secondary outcomes of this research project?
So what we decided to use as our primary outcome was total IV hydromorphone delivered by PCA in the first 24 hours of surgery. And the reason we selected this is patients typically require quite a bit of pain medication this first 24 hours after major spine surgery. What we used as secondary endpoints were IV hydromorphone requirements by PCA on days 2 and 3 and total use over 3 days. And, you know, obviously, since these patients transition from the IV medication to the oral pain medication, we also looked at the total consumption of hydrocodone tablets during the first 3 days and over 72 hours. Also, what we decided to look at in this study, which, again, is a very important secondary endpoint, is pain scores. And we assessed pain scores at rest, with coughing, and with movement. And we did this with our research team when the patients got to PACU, 1 hour after PACU arrival, and on the morning and late afternoons of postoperative days 1 through 3. And finally, we looked at patient satisfaction with pain management. How happy were patients with how we managed their pain postoperatively?
Dr. Murphy, did you also look at rates of adverse events?
Yes, you know, I think that was very important to do in this study because I think a lot of clinicians are reluctant to use methadone because they're concerned this is a long-acting agent. Would it produce long-acting respiratory depression? Again, that's not really supported by the data, but that is a significant concern of many clinicians. So we very carefully assess patients for episodes of hypoxia, which we defined as SATs less than 90%, and for episodes of hypoventilation, which were patients breathing less than 8 breaths a minute, during the first 72 hours. So the patients were monitored, obviously, continuously in the PACU, and the majority of our patients went to continuous pulse oximetry monitoring for the first 24 hours. And while they were assessed at regular intervals by my research team, who also talked to the nursing staff who was taking care of these patients to look for these episodes of hypoxia and hypoventilation. And then when the patients were transferred to the floor, the patients were assessed at regular time intervals by my research team, who also then would talk to the nurses to determine if they had seen any of these episodes, why the patient was being monitored. You know, also we looked at patients for other opioid-related side effects, which were sedation, nausea and vomiting and itching. And finally, again, because these patients were getting an infusion of ketamine, we looked for the most common side effects related to that, hallucinations, vivid dreams, and dizziness.
Sounds like quite a comprehensive evaluation of these patients. Dr. Clark, do we have information already on the clinical interactions of methadone and ketamine?
Well, with respect to the interaction of the two drugs, we have only a little bit of information. We certainly have evidence that each drug alone is effective in reducing opiate consumption, and perhaps after spinal surgery, particularly methadone. However, the effects of ketamine combined with a background of more commonly used opioids are only fairly modest. We did have one report in the literature of the combination of methadone with ketamine. That was a study in which the drugs were combined in a PCA format, or patient-controlled analgesia format, and there was a fairly large, almost 70% reduction in opioid use. That suggests there's something special about the combination, even though we don't understand much about that.
So, Dr. Murphy, can you tell us a bit more about the population of patients and the type or types of surgeries that you included in this study?
Sure. What we were looking at was a relatively healthy patient population undergoing a major surgical procedure, spinal fusion surgery. We looked at 130 patients between ages of 18 and 80, and we basically excluded this sort of the high-risk patients because we knew this. We were trying something new, so we wanted to look at relatively healthy patients. We excluded ASA 4 and 5 patients and anyone with severe renal, pulmonary, or liver disease from enrollment in the study.
Why did you choose to study patients having spine surgeries?
You know, the reason is, and I think all of us who have these type of patients in our practice realize how difficult pain is to manage in this patient population. If you look at studies, they show that patients undergoing spinal fusion surgery really have the highest level of postoperative pain. They typically have median pain scores of 7 or 8. So these are very challenging patients postoperatively as far as managing their pain. And it's not surprising they come in oftentimes in significant pain. Oftentimes, these patients are on preoperative opioids, which leads to tolerance, hyperalgesia, and allodynia. They oftentimes have a lot of anxiety, which can make the pain worse. And then they're undergoing this major surgical procedure. So it's not surprising. These patients have significant levels of postoperative pain.
Yeah, and I also think you mentioned a bit about the component of neuropathic pain. And I wonder if Dr. Clark, perhaps, you could expand a bit on that component in this particular population of patients and how this affects pain management.
Well, the population that was studied is somewhat unique from the perspective of having neuropathic pain, and that can be from at least two sources. The first source is neuropathic pain that's emanating from the condition leading to the surgery, which in this case was spinal stenosis. This is actually a fairly common form of neuropathic pain or a common cause of it, and it can affect the patient's back and legs, including areas that might become painful because of the surgery. The second is neuropathic pain from the surgery itself, and this can come from the transection of nerves, the liberation of inflammatory mediators around those nerves, traction on segmental nerves during the surgery. And finally, the fact that there can be irritation of spinal nerves, which are very, very close to the targets of the surgery as the decompressions are performed. Neuropathic pain in general may have a special sensitivity to the agents, which were ketamine and methadone, that were used by Dr. Murphy and his team for the study.
So, Dr. Murphy, can you tell us a bit more about the specifics of the actual protocol that you used?
Sure. So in this study, we had 130 patients. They were randomized to one of two groups. They were randomized to a methadone ketamine group, which got a dose of methadone at the start of surgery, then an intraoperative infusion of ketamine, which was continued for 48 hours, or a methadone group, which was our control group, which got a dose of intraoperative methadone at the start of surgery, then an intraoperative and postoperative infusion of just D5W. So specifically what we did is the clinicians were handed a 3cc syringe that contained 0.2 milligrams per kilogram of methadone, which was given to all patients in both groups. Then clinicians were also given a 500cc bag of D5W, which contained either 250 milligrams of ketamine or just D5W. The bags were basically hooked up to a pump and set to deliver ketamine or the equivalent volume of D5W at 0.3 milligrams per kilogram per hour intraoperatively, which when they started closing, we reduced that to 0.1 milligram per kilogram per hour, which was continued in the PACU and for the next 48 hours. We carefully standardized anesthesia in both groups. And when patients got to the PACU, they were given IV hydromorphone by the PACU nursing staff and then hooked up to a PCA containing the same drug. And then finally, when they were able to tolerate PO intake, they were transitioned to Norco tablets. And then basically, our research team carefully assessed these patients for the primary and secondary outcomes when the patients got to the PACU plus 1 hour, in the morning and late afternoons of postoperative days 1 through 3.
Dr. Clark, can we maybe talk a little bit more about methadone? How does it work and what is unique about it?
Well, we all probably know something about methadone, whether we use it regularly in our practices or not. If you would ask a person on the street about methadone, they would probably say, that's the drug addicts get. But you ask an anesthesiologist, and she might tell you that methadone is a very long-acting mu opioid receptor agonist. And while all opioids have unique pharmacological personalities, methadone's special features include things like the ability to reduce NMDA receptor activity and perhaps, although there's a little less data, to reduce the reuptake of serotonin and norepinephrine in the central nervous system, effects also linked to reduced pain. In the laboratory and perhaps in patients, methadone may have special advantages when treating neuropathic pain for reasons that aren't entirely clear.
Dr. Murphy, how did you choose the doses of methadone and ketamine that you used?
And that's a great question because, you know, really the optimal dose of both drugs is really uncertain, whether you're using them alone or whether you're using them in combination. Now, if you look at the literature, the dose of 0.2 milligrams per kilogram is really the most commonly used, and that just came from some of the initial studies. No one's really done good dose response curves with methadone to determine what the optimal dose is. So that's why we selected that dose, and we actually based our dose on ideal body weight to give us a slightly smaller dose because we were combining with ketamine, which we hadn't done before. And again, with the ketamine, you know, reviewing the literature, finding what is the really optimal dose of ketamine to use for surgery, again, that's really poorly defined, I think even less so than with methadone. You know, if you look at the literature, the doses intraoperatively ranged significantly. It seemed basically to me the most common dose was about 0.5 milligrams per kilogram. So I actually tried that clinically, and I found some of the patients were a little slow to wake up. So that's why basically a lot of this dose came from just my clinical practice. I was using methadone and ketamine in my patients and sort of just trying to figure out what doses seemed to work for the patients. That dose of 0.3 milligrams per kilogram intraoperatively reduced to 0.1 milligram per kilogram, in my clinical experience, actually worked pretty well.
So, Dr. Clark, methadone is not a new drug, but it's fair to say it's had a mixed legacy. And I think the same can be said about ketamine. But they both seem to be having a bit of a renaissance. Why is that?
Well, I like and agree with the term renaissance, but I think the term applies a little differently to each drug. Ketamine has become very popular over the past several years for several reasons. One is its ability to reduce postoperative opiate requirements and maybe reduce postoperative pain. But it certainly also has some utility in the treatment of chronic pain syndromes, for example, complex regional pain syndrome. As well as to reduce depression, if for only a short period of time, maybe a week or two. Perhaps those listening are familiar with the new drug esketamine, which is now FDA approved for the short-term treatment of depression. Methadone, on the other hand, seems to be coming back into favor because it's a drug that can provide a stable platform of analgesia postoperatively, which minimizes the need for other more aggressive postoperative opioid or alternative analgesic strategies. Up to this time, however, there doesn't seem to have been much interest in combining the two drugs, which is really the special contribution of the study by Dr. Murphy and his colleagues.
So, Dr. Murphy, we've discussed a bit about how aggressively you evaluated for adverse outcomes. And we know, in fact, that methadone and I think ketamine do have reputations, rightly or wrongly. Sometimes I wonder how really they're associated with more adverse outcomes. But, you know, I know people talk about hallucinations and hypoxia and ventilatory depression. And yet you continued the ketamine, at least, well into the postoperative period and on a floor, I believe, right, on a ward with only pulse oximetry monitoring. And you had already given a long-acting, you know, opioid. Was this an issue with the IRB approval, or is this standard of care in your practice?
Well, you know, actually, this is a practice using methadone and ketamine for patients who are undergoing complex spine surgery. It was actually not uncommon amongst my colleagues. And, you know, you're right about reputation. If, you know, I've heard the same things about methadone and ketamine, but when you actually look at the literature, it's surprising. It's really not, those sort of reputations aren't supported by the literature. There was just a meta-analysis published in Pain looking at methadone, and they found when comparing methadone patients to those who got standard opioids, there was no increased risk of adverse events, including respiratory events. And I recently did a narrative review for this journal on methadone. Again, looked at all the published literature, and I wasn't really able to find any evidence that methadone was associated with increased adverse events. Now, I have to say the important limitation, most of these studies are generally pretty small. You know, before you make any definitive conclusions that this is just as safe as everything else, I think we really benefit for additional larger scale studies to really help answer that question. But it's the same thing with ketamine, too. If you look at ketamine and you look at the meta-analysis, the majority of meta-analysis seem to suggest that there's not an increased risk of adverse events, and some that there is an increased risk of hallucinations. But so if there's an increased risk, it's relatively small. So again, I think these reputations of these drugs are somewhat undeserved.
Yeah, I happen to agree. And I think that, you know, nobody, you know, wakes up from anesthesia or in the immediate postoperative period, you know, remarks on how well they feel, regardless of what drugs we use, right? So
yeah.
I guess pick your complications or side effects and trade-offs. Dr. Clark, what do you think about the protocol that Dr. Murphy used, especially the doses of methadone and ketamine? Were these the correct doses?
Well, I liked it a lot. I thought the protocol was entirely pragmatic and very practical. I want to emphasize that this was a study done at a private hospital with very real-world surgical flow considerations. There were no special measures that were required here. Methadone was used at about 0.2 milligrams per kilogram, which is 15 milligrams or so for the average patient, given during induction. That is a practical thing to do. And a reasonable dose for a moderately long case. Could have been higher or could have been lower, but this was reasonable. The ketamine dose at 0.1 to 0.3 milligrams per kilogram per hour was, again, very typical for how ketamine infusions are used, with the one caveat that Dr. Murphy and his team were fortunate to be able to continue these infusions for 48 hours after the surgery. Not all nursing wards can support that kind of post-operative use. Nevertheless, it's common. And furthermore, the side effects attributable to either drug or the drugs used in combination were infrequent and minor. So I think we could call these very safe doses of drugs that were selected.
So Dr. Murphy, what did you find?
Okay, so when we looked at our primary outcome measure, which was IV hydromorphone given by PC over 24 hours, we found that the dose was reduced from 4.6 milligrams in the methadone group to 2.0 milligrams in the methadone ketamine group. So a more than 50% reduction in the need for the first 24 hours. We also found that our use over the first 3 days was also reduced by about 50%. And again, when we looked at how many pain pills, oral pain hydrocodone medication patients needed, patients in the methadone group required 20 tablets over the first 3 days versus 11 tablets in the methadone ketamine group. So analgesic requirements were significantly better. But I think even more importantly, when we looked at pain scores at rest with coughing and with movement, they were all significantly less in the methadone ketamine group from the time they got to the PACU to the end of postoperative day three, with the exception of one measurement time, which was pain at rest on postoperative day two. And I think most importantly, you know, median pain scores at rest and with coughing were reduced to mild levels at many of these assessment times. that was my primary goal. Could we get people comfortable enough, which we actually saw there was a significant improvement. I think one thing that always speaks well of a study, if a surgeon compliments it, I had one of our old school, very crusty thoracic spine surgeons come up to me and say, Murphy, I don't know what you're doing with the study, but whatever you're doing for those study patients, I want you to keep doing it for my patients. So when your surgeons sort of notice a difference between study groups, I think that's always a positive sign towards a study. But we didn't find when we looked at our patient satisfaction scores that they were really any better in the methadone ketamine group, with the exception of the first postoperative morning. So those were the outcomes that we looked at.
No, I agree. Congratulations. The surgeons are our toughest customers. So what about adverse events? Did you observe any difference there?
Again, as we mentioned, we looked very carefully at that. We didn't see any difference in the incidence of adverse events between groups.
Now, Dr. Clark, in your editorial, you write that ketamine appears to have, I think you used the word, boosted the effects of methadone. And you actually compare this to other combination drugs. Can you tell us more? Is there a pharmacokinetic or pharmacodynamic explanation for this?
Thank you for that question. I apologize for the somewhat complicated and maybe not entirely fully demonstrated possibilities here, but there are a few. The first is, and maybe the simplest, is that ketamine was simply providing analgesia that provided some additional pain relief as the effects of methadone faded postoperatively. Maybe this is true. However, the difference between the groups was largest early on, and the patients had access to other IV and oral opioids throughout the study. Another possibility already mentioned is that the two drugs could have interacted at the level of the NMDA receptor. Again, this is possible. However, I have to point out that methadone at the doses given was probably present at only about a tenth the concentration needed to significantly impact NMDA receptor function, while ketamine was almost certainly interacting with the receptor. And finally, ketamine may have been reducing opioid hyperalgesia in the spine surgery patients due both to pre- and intraoperative opioid use that were common. About 50% of these patients came to the operating room consuming opioids chronically, and the investigators used significant remifentanil infusions during the course of the surgery. Ketamine has been shown to reduce opiate hyperalgesia both in clinical populations and in the laboratory.
Dr. Murphy, I know your primary goal was to evaluate for postoperative pain control and management, but I'm curious, did you find any differences between your study groups in regards to wake-up time or PACU duration, length of stay?
You know, that was a bit of a disappointment. We hypothesized by enhancing analgesia that we'd have basically enhanced recovery. And when we looked at basically all those outcome measures, we really didn't see a difference between groups.
I know Dr. Clark mentioned that these patients had gotten remifentanil as well. And Dr. Murphy, you discussed the possible effects it may have had in this study. Can you provide us a bit more specifics on what you think it will take to get providers to either stop using this drug or at least consider the consequences, and why did you provide remifentanil?
That's an excellent question, and like you, I'm not really a fan of remifentanil. But the problem is many of my colleagues use this during spine surgery because it's a titratable drug. And you think about it, it's sort of the opposite end of the spectrum from methadone. So really the primary reason I decided to use this was to increase the acceptance of my colleagues towards patient enrollment in the study. Now, again, working in a private practice setting and doing research, I find if I change the way people have to do things too much, they really are unhappy and it won't allow me to sign patients up. So really was a very pragmatic decision based upon needing to sign people up. And actually what it does is it complicates the interpretation of the findings. By adding another opioid, which causes hypoalgesia, it really does complicate the interpretation of the findings. And, you know, if you look at the data supporting methadone, I think it's pretty good that the use of this drug reduces analgesic requirements and pain scores postoperatively. When you look at remifentanil, there's really no data that patients do better with this. And it actually, as we talked about, may contribute to hyperalgesia. So, again, if I was doing this case on my own, I would not be using remifentanil. But I included it as part of the protocol just so I could get my colleagues to participate in the study.
No, I think that's one of the benefits of actually this study, even though I, you know, you read in between the lines that I am not a fan of remifentanil, but I think of it specifically for neuro cases and when there's neural monitoring, it's almost like it's just like the IV fluid. You got to give remifentanil. So I think that by including that, you did make this a very practical, very relatable study for people who do these kinds of cases. So, Dr. Clark, this is actually my anniversary podcast from 5 years ago when I first started this. And I believe this is the first time I've ever asked anyone to read verbatim from their actual manuscript. But you have a couple of sentences where you discuss multimodal analgesia, and you were so articulate, I believe, in your summarization. Can you maybe read directly from your paper if you have it in front of you there, maybe starting with the multimodal analgesia being a quote-unquote centerpiece?
Well, first of all, I'd like to congratulate you on your 5-year tenure, and thank you so much for doing these podcasts. I'll also offer an apology to those who don't like flowery language, because I may have employed some here in writing the editorial, but I think what you're referring to is the following. Multimodal analgesia is a contemporary centerpiece of the perioperative protocol banquet, and such protocols are widely espoused and often enthusiastically embraced. While perhaps sometimes beneficial, they're also insufficiently tested and are unfortunately often found less effective than believed or desired when they're finally formally evaluated. Now, what that says in arguably too many words is that we had a problem, Dr. Karish and I, in writing the editorial with the concept that more is always better. We seem to be in a pattern of throwing the kitchen sink at patients when we design multimodal strategies. It's with the best of intentions and even with fair reasoning. We use drugs and techniques that have different mechanisms of action. However, what we are seeing now emerging in the literature is that more is not always better, and that adding additional drugs often provides clinically insignificant incremental benefit. That is a different thing from what was observed by Dr. Murphy. What is remarkable about the study that was reported by Dr. Murphy and his colleagues is that the ketamine provided a really very substantial benefit, almost a halving of the opiate requirement postoperatively, and substantially improved pain scores as well. So this is an example of a success and a clear demonstration of the benefit of the two drugs, methadone and ketamine.
I love the way you worded that. I thought it was very memorable. And I think, again, you emphasize that we just need to study what we do, right? And we need data. And this is what Dr. Murphy has done for us here. So, Dr. Murphy, in the introduction section of your paper, you included a reference, I think, when you stated that 80% of surgical patients in the United States have postoperative pain, and 88% of those rate the pain moderate to severe. Considering the number of surgeries that we do, that is a lot of patients. Did this reference also include ambulatory surgeries, and do you know how this compares perhaps to the rest of the world?
I think, you know, as anesthesiologists, we continuously underestimate what postoperative pain levels are. That actual reference is from a report from the U.S. Institute of Medicine, and there's also just recently an article published by T.J. Gann, a large U.S. Postal survey, showing almost identical results to this. And what's interesting when you look is that this includes, it's not the big surgeries, but the minor surgeries. In my investigation and discussion, I talk about a study that came out of Germany, which evaluated pain scores in 179 surgeries on postoperative day one. And, you know, not surprisingly, things like spine surgery had very high pain levels. But even minor surgical procedures like appendectomies, cholecystectomies, hemorrhoidectomies, tonsillectomies, some of these procedures that we think aren't very painful actually had pretty significant postoperative pain associated with it. So, you know, I think in this era particularly when we're looking to use less and less opioids in the operating room, we have to be cognizant of really what these postoperative pain levels are.
Dr. Clark, you write also in your editorial that, I believe, quote, there is much enthusiasm about ketamine. And we've spoken a little bit about the sort of popularity of it more recently. And that the magnitude of adding this to methadone was substantially greater than reported with other opioids. Can you expand a bit on this and why this may have been so important in Dr. Murphy's study, either with the population of patients, the surgeries, or this particular combination of ketamine and methadone?
This was really one of the central findings of the study. Again, ketamine isn't the magic drug some would imagine it to be. It's thought of sometimes as having secret powers in the perioperative period. In fact, large reviews involving thousands of patients suggest that the overall effects of ketamine in most settings to reduce pain postoperatively and opiate consumption are that it has perhaps statistically significant effects, but not always clinically meaningful ones. On the other hand, in Dr. Murphy's study, opiate consumption was reduced by 50% or even more early after the surgery, and pain scores were reduced by about 30% or so. Both of those percentages would be considered highly clinically significant. It was difficult for me anyway to predict that those changes might have been observed before the study was done. So there seems to be something very special about this ketamine-methadone interaction, even if we don't yet fully understand it.
Dr. Murphy, you did this study, and most of your research up to this point, I believe, while working in what we would call a private practice here in the United States. And I suspect that many of our listeners think that research and private practice anesthesiology are not compatible. How did you do all this?
Well, I think there's really great opportunities for research in the private practice setting. I think it just requires, you know, a supportive department, especially starting out doing simple studies, designing studies that you can do within the clinical framework of where you're working and answering questions that you find are clinically relevant. Like, this is a perfect example. This study, I was using methadone and ketamine in my spine patients, and it's something I learned from one of my colleagues who came from another institution. And I said, wow, this is really fantastic. It seems to be working well. This is something we should examine. So I was lucky at the institution I was at that I had a chairman who was supportive of research. And basically, with just a little bit of financial support, we were able to complete this study. So I think there really is great opportunity in private practice for research. It's just finding and creating those opportunities.
So one last question, Dr. Murphy. If you were having a similar spine surgery as the patients in your study, what anesthetic management would you want?
I think exactly this. This is what I do for my patients, and this is what I think I would like for myself.
I hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read these important articles to learn more. Thank you, Drs. Murphy and Clark, for discussing your work with us today. I wish you well as you continue your efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
Pleasure being here today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.